This is Hear Me Out. I'm Celeste Headlee. You probably know we're facing a housing affordability crisis in this country. Maybe you're one of the 23% of homeowners and 50% of renters who are cost burdened, meaning you spend more than a third of your income on housing. One in six American households spend more than half of their income on housing. It's a widespread issue and it touches all of us. That's not even mentioning the roughly 600,000 Americans who are now unhoused. A lot of people blame capitalism and the private housing sector for this crisis. But what if the private sector is actually the answer?
I'm trying to argue that, you know, developers are out there building in the communities and they can be a part of this solution and want to be.
John McMillan joins Hear Me Out in just a moment. Stay with us.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
Welcome back to Hear Me Out. I'm Celeste Headlee. The nation is facing a housing crisis. Most Americans agree with that statement, regardless of political party. But solutions often get mired in partisan politics. That's because this big problem is really lots of smaller problems. Zoning laws, for example, are handled on the city or state levels. Inflation, the cost of living, those are connected but unique, complicated issues. And there's the question of too much demand for a short supply. The mortgage financer Freddie Mac says we're short about 4 million homes right now. Progressives like Bernie Sanders and AOC say the answer is more public housing. But a chapter in a new book about the housing crisis argues a better solution could be found by leaning more into capitalism and letting the private sector market work it all out. John McMillan is Senior Vice President and Director of Planning at TF Cornerstone, a development firm. He's also now a published writer with a chapter in the new book, Housing the Nation. So first, congratulations, John.
Thank you.
So for those who don't know you or what TF Cornerstone is, can you tell us who you are and what you do?
Well, I am an urban planner, and I started my career at Battery Park City, where I was director of planning, and then I was hired by this company, which I would say specializes in very large-scale public-private sector partnerships. So we do large housing projects, you know, on city land, on state land, in partnership with the government. Most of our stuff involves lots of approvals with communities and local elected officials. So I come into contact with that crowd quite a bit. And my role is to sort of oversee the design of these projects and then get them approved, you know, in government.
Okay, so what is the elevator pitch? Most people obviously will not have read the chapter that you wrote for the book with your argument in it. So what's the bottom line here? What is your claim?
Well, my claim is that developers build all of our housing and always have. And they are an enormous resource that we should harness to help us solve this problem of the need for more affordable housing. You know, governments don't really know how to build housing. So when we say we need more public housing, what do we mean by that? I think ultimately we mean find ways to get developers to build it for us. And my point is that, you know, there are enormous resources, enormous expertise and experience, and we should figure out how to harness that and motivate the private sector developers
to be part of the affordable housing solution, i.e. make it part of what they do on a regular basis. So when a private developer goes out and builds 100 units of housing, we ought to find a way that 25 or 30% of that can be made affordable. And that's clearly the most efficient way to produce the most affordable units.
Except that hasn't been working so far. And I want to make sure we're all agreeing on what affordable means. A lot of people, when they hear the phrase affordable housing, they think about what I mentioned earlier, public housing. But they're not the same thing. Affordable housing, according to most definitions, is just housing that the average middle-class family can afford. And the U.S. government thinks we should not be paying more than 30% of our salaries toward housing. Is that the same definition you
use? Well, the problem is it's a meaningless term, and it's very confusing to all of us because it doesn't mean anything in particular. A better term might be income-restricted or even subsidized. But the point is that the rent that people in affordable units are paying is not enough to cover the cost of constructing and operating that unit, and therefore it needs to be subsidized. So that, in my opinion, is the definition of affordable housing.
I would argue that we shouldn't, if affordable housing, at least the housing that's subsidized, shouldn't need to reach the, say, 18 to 20% profit margin that most builder firms, corporations, companies make. I mean, builders are making money, and even during a very, very tough housing time in terms of high costs for materials and lumber and really high interest rates, the profit margins for construction projects are still going up. But
So I disagree with that.
So that's what analysis of more than 10,000 projects found, that profit margins grew from about 14.4% in 2019 to just under 15% in 2021. And again, very high prices for lumber and other materials and very high interest rates. So we have this issue of how much profit should subsidized housing generate if we are balancing out the profit that our system allows building companies to make on their non-subsidized housing.
Okay.
Because they're making enough money.
I argue that there is no profit in affordable housing. There is only loss because you can't get enough rent to cover the cost of producing that unit. You're talking about profits on market rate housing.
Yeah.
We're talking here about affordable housing. There is no profit in affordable housing. So there's no point in talking about eliminating the profit motive in affordable housing because there is none. There is only loss. And the only question is, how do you plug that gap? How do you make up that loss? Do you either ask the developer to do it by sort of cross-subsidizing with the market rate units in a building, or do you ask the government to step in and subsidize that loss? There is no profit by definition.
Yeah. And I absolutely agree, and I don't think there should be a profit in subsidized housing. But I also think that oftentimes, even now, builders are incentivized to build affordable units. And again, by affordable units, we're not always talking about housing projects that many people think of. They're often incentivized to do that by getting tax breaks or a particular land deal will get right on because they agree to build a certain number of affordable units.
That's right. But that is how government steps in to cover the loss from the affordable units with that tax break. Other developers,
but that's not working.
Not-for-profit developers are, let's use the word, incentivized to build affordable housing by way of a fee. And that's just what they call their profit. They charge a fee, which is a charge for the services and the time involved in producing the building. So it's like part of the cost of the project.
Right.
Whereas the profit developer has to sit around and wait for income to exceed expenses in order to realize any return from their endeavors.
Okay, except that oftentimes the fact, I mean, we've, over the years, our sort of economic view of housing has changed, right? Like, it's often called the financialization of housing. Like, there's been structural changes in these markets.
Yes.
to where housing is now being treated like a commodity.
Correct.
A means of accumulating wealth. So what ends up happening is you have luxury apartments that were built to generate a massive amount of profit that are now sitting empty. I looked up at data from Mansion Global, and it said that in Hudson Yards, for example, half of the luxury apartments there are empty, while a lot of New Yorkers are sleeping on the street.
Well, but what do the two have? What do the two have to do with each other?
Well, here's what the two have to do to each other. If we're talking about whether builders can afford to build affordable housing, and again, we're just talking about a working class family being able to spend less than 30% right now, people are spending over half their salaries on housing. Perhaps this focus on the financialization of housing that makes it so attractive for people to build luxury apartments, perhaps that the whole system that is set up is the problem.
Fine. So, I mean, if we want to go after capitalism, I'm all for that. But the structure that we've got here, you know, the money is going to chase after the highest rate of returns. And there's not, I don't see that that's the problem here. The problem is a different one. It's just that in order for anybody to build affordable housing, whether a not-for-profit developer, a profit, or even the government, they all face the same landscape of costs. They've all got the same land costs, construction costs, and labor costs. And when they build that unit of housing, they're going to need $5,000 a month in rent to cover the cost of having produced and having to operate that unit of housing. Meanwhile, the poor family can only afford $2,000 a month. And so you have this $3,000 gap. And it doesn't matter who's doing this. It's the same for anybody. And the only question here is, how do you make up that gap? Or how do you lower the cost of constructing new affordable housing? Or how do you raise people's incomes, you know, so that they can better afford the housing that we produce? But the fact that some guy is over there in Hudson Yards building a bunch of luxury units for people who never show up, I just don't see how that's relevant here.
Well, it's relevant because that's the same guy who says, I'm building luxury units because I can't afford to build affordable housing.
He can't afford it because he's going to lose money on it unless somebody steps in to subsidize it.
He's losing money on his Hudson Yards. For example, another analysis of, and I'm taking New York real estate because you and I both know that's some of the most, besides San Francisco, some of the most expensive. So the data that I found on this is a little bit dated. It's a few years old. But 30% of all apartments in the area from 49th to 70th, between 5th and Park, are vacant at least 10 months a year. And again, those are units that could be used to house all the people that they're throwing in jail because they're unhoused. And I absolutely hear what you're saying, that at the way that the system is set up right now, they can't afford to build the affordable houses. But I am also saying that as a whole, if we take the housing industry as on the meta scale, there's a problem with the way builders are making money, the kind of profit margins they're expecting, and the kind of units they're building, period.
Well,
and if we shift that framing, we might be able to solve this problem.
I'm not sure that mainstream economists would agree with that. Most of them argue that the more housing we produce, you know, the greater the supply, and that will lower costs. And so to the extent that people are building all these units that aren't occupied, you know, eventually something has to break there and those units need to re-enter the system. And theoretically, you know, that should add to the supply and bring down costs. So I don't see any problem with adding to the supply. And if owners are keeping the units off the market because they can't find anyone to buy them or rent them, you know, that's a temporary phenomenon, and eventually they're going to have to lower their costs and find something to do with that unit, which can only be done by, you know, bringing their prices down to the point where there will be some demand for it.
Okay, we have to take a break, but this is a great discussion. There is a lot to talk about here, and I want to get back to it. This is Hear Me Out, a podcast from Slate. I'm Celeste Headlee, and we're talking about affordable housing, if it exists anymore. We'll be back in just a moment, so stay with us.
Thank you.
I know it feels like we're all in information overload. We can follow that rabbit hole on the internet or doom scroll on our social media feeds and get a lot of information. And yet we forget the beauty of wondering. Wondering what answers are, wondering what the context is of certain hot topics, especially hot topics like Israel, Judaism, Zionism. There is a lot to wonder about right now, and it's really hard to know who to trust and where to turn for good information. Now we have a weekly podcast from Unpacked called Wondering Jews with Michal and Noam. Join hosts and educators extraordinaire Michal Bitten and Noam Weissman as they tackle these topics and a lot of uncomfortable questions that surround them. Their goal is to work toward answers together with their listeners. Doesn't matter where you're from. If you have ever wondered about anything, this is the right podcast for you. So check it out. Subscribe to Wondering Jews with Michal and Noam on your favorite podcast app today. Wondering Jews is brought to you by Unpacked, a division of Open Door Media.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
Welcome back. This is Hear Me Out, a podcast from Slate. I'm Celeste Headlee, and we're talking today with John McMillan about how to solve the housing crisis in the United States. And just before we took the break, John, you were talking about the idea of the law of supply and demand, right? That if there are luxury apartments, and at this point, there's actually a lot of office spaces that are empty.
Yeah.
Obviously, landlords and building companies won't be able to sustain that loss for very long. And the idea is those prices will come down.
Right.
That has not happened yet. But there are also, we see across the country, and not just in the most expensive cities like LA and New York and San Francisco, even among the number of apartments, for example, that are classed as affordable, many of them are held off the market by landlords. There was one extensive survey that showed, now the range is wildly in terms of the estimate. We don't entirely know since landlords don't always give us the data. But there was somewhere possibly up to 60,000 rent-stabilized units that have been held off the market for a number of reasons. They claim it's not cost-effective for them, and then they're held empty. It's a process that's often called warehousing, and we don't know how many units there are. So there's this other issue of, are we actually making all of the affordable units out there available to people?
Yes, I agree. I don't actually know too much about that. My territory is sort of the economics of new construction, but to the extent that I understand that phenomenon, it's that owners, you know, have invested in the rehabilitation of these units, but the rent regulations do not allow them to raise rents enough to cover those costs. So instead of incurring that loss, they just decide to hold the units off the market and wait. And I don't know what the solution to that is.
I would say the solution might be that we should have more oversight and accountability. But then let's move on to something that you probably do know more about, which is that there's kind of no such thing as affordable housing in the U.S. And I say that because the vast majority of people make, you know, the median salary in the U.S. is somewhere around $50,000 to $75,000. Let's go back to New York, because again, major housing problem in New York. The average salary in Manhattan is $79,000 a year. That's $6,600 a month and change. The average monthly rent for a 2-bedroom apartment in Manhattan is about $5,500 a month. That's according to both RentHop and Zumper.
Right.
And I looked on the real estate listings and I found several two-bedroom condos for sale there at a median price of $1.6 million. Now, again, we're looking at the most some of the most expensive real estate in the country, but I looked in Poughkeepsie. I looked in cities all around the country. And the fact of the matter is that housing is out of reach for a massive millions upon millions of Americans, period.
Right.
Even disregarding affordable, new construction of affordable
and
housing.
And all that pricing that you just referenced is a function of supply and demand. So clearly there's more demand for this stuff than there is supply, and that pushes the prices of housing, you know, beyond the means of most people. And so most economists would tell us that we need to build more and increase supply.
I don't know if that's true. I mean, I wish that were true. It would be awesome if that's how capitalism worked and people simply had a lot of demand for a product and they put a fair price on it that brought them a fair profit and then they made their money. But that's not how it works. There's been so many problems with companies like Blackstone buying up properties and then immediately jacking up the rent by hundreds, if not thousands of dollars. And that's not a lack of demand. Most of the time, there's people already living there.
What Blackstone is doing, they're not able to increase, you know, they're not sort of pricing the housing to increase their profit margin. They're pricing the housing according to what the demand will bear. And they're no different from the small scale developer. They'll price the unit as high as they can get in the market. And that's kind of the way things work in this country.
Yeah, but again, I don't think that's how it should work. They're not pricing it according to the most they can get that's reasonable. They're pricing it according to the absolute most they can get and still fill those units. And they'll do it. They'll keep raising it until they can't fill them all anymore.
Exactly.
And the problem is, John, is that we have so many people that simply get dumped out of their houses. And we're not talking about unemployed people, not that they should be unhoused anyway, but the number of unhoused people in the United States has increased by 11% just over 1 year's time. It's the largest increase in 15 years. Plus, we have a system that criminalizes homelessness. So you have working people, sometimes two jobs in a family, who get priced out of the home they're already in and often become unhoused, not because of, you know, there's a problem with supply and demand. It's because Blackstone or some other company is simply trying to see how much higher they can raise those prices. And there's nobody out there, no government regulatory agency, no one who says, hey, listen, you can't evict people because your profit margins are too low. And my opinion is there should be.
So you're sort of conflating developers with the Blackstones. And, you know, I work for a family-owned development company. We've been around for 65 years, and we work with communities long term, and we understand their problems, and we want to be part of the solution. I don't think that's true of the Blackstones, right? They're doing it all from afar, and that's a different universe. And so I'm trying to argue that, you know, developers are out there building in the communities, and they can be a part of this solution and want to be a part of the solution. And I don't think they think in the same way as the Blackstones. I think what you're talking about here is some kind of massive governmental intervention here to better regulate this kind of stuff. And of course, as you know, we don't have that kind of regulation on a national or federal basis. We have it, you know, piecemeal on a local municipal basis. There, you know, the housing market in New York City is enormously regulated. And as you know, we have millions of stabilized and controlled apartments, and that's all highly regulated. We have legislators in Albany trying to make the rest of the apartments in New York regulated. But it seems to me that's the only solution that you're talking about here is governmental intervention here in the market. That this is not something that the market is going to be able to solve on its own, because again, we've just got these underlying economics where the cost of producing this stuff
is more than people can afford. So then, you know, you have to ask the question, well, why is that? And that, of course, has to do with local zoning and all that sort of stuff. You know, again, people would argue the overregulation of the production of housing has limited the supply and has led to this problem that you just described.
I mean, I think you and I agree on a lot of things here, but I would say that, yes, there needs to be an overhaul, but one of the first steps is that we should not be treating housing as a commodity. That's how it's
being
treated
right now.
Well, we do,
but we do. Okay, that's just
I know, but we shouldn't. And that should be a solution there, where real estate investment trusts and private equity funds and financial asset management firms and all these investment vehicles are not trying to maximize profit on something that should be a right, that is somebody's home. I think treating it as a commodity that ends up in these financial asset management firms is one of the things that's causing people to raise prices simply to show a higher profit to stockholders. And that's a big part of our problem.
I'm not sure that's a big part of the problem. I agree it's not, you know, it generally hasn't been a good factor in housing. But I think that any owner of a unit, say you own a brownstone and your family is on the top two floors and you're going to rent out the basement and you're trying to cover your costs and you just renovated that apartment, you know, are you going to rent it for $1,000 or $2,000? You're going to rent it for as much as you can because you're trying to meet your own needs, whatever they might be. That's just kind of a natural function of human nature and capitalism. And I think to sort of begin to unwind that, you know, requires fundamental rethinking of the way our government works here. And I'm not saying that I'm not in favor of that, but I mean, you're talking kind of big time changes here, and that's beyond my pay grade.
It's behind mine, too, but we do have to take a break and then we'll come back. I'm Celeste Headley, and we're talking about affordable housing on Hear Me Out, a podcast from Slate. We will return. We're back. This is Hear Me Out. I'm Celeste Headley, and I am back talking about housing with John McMillan and talking about how to solve it. Now, John has a great chapter in a book called Housing the Nation, in which he says it's not cost effective for builders to build new affordable housing. Somebody has to fill that gap between what it costs to build it and what they can charge for it. And as I understand it, John, you think the government should do that through subsidies, right?
No, not really. I think, so that's my point, is that if you can find a way to harness the profit, as you call it, or income that that the private sector developer can create in the production of this housing and funnel those profits into the affordable units, then to me that is the home run. And so so what I argue for is a building where you have 75% of the units as market rate units and let the developer make as much profit off those units as possible, but capture some of that profit and use it to plug the gap of the 25% of units in the building that are affordable and are not covering, where the rent is not covering their costs. So it's a sort of a profit capture mechanism that is taking advantage of what capitalism and what this hot housing market is able to do, the value it and the incomes it is able to produce. Let's capture that and use it for affordable housing. And that was essentially, you know, I call this the developer incentive program. And in New York, we called it 421A. And the idea was the gap would be shared between the developer, who is utilizing the profits from the market rate units, and then the city would pitch in a break on the real estate taxes, and those two pieces together would cover the gap from the losses of the affordable units. So I just think that's a really sweet system where both the developer and the city are helping to cover this gap. Otherwise, the government has to cover it all by itself. And so if you have a not-for-profit developer who goes out and builds 100% affordable housing, every one of those units is going to lose money. And so the government has to step in and provide 100% of those losses, 100% of the subsidy needed to make that building cover its costs. So you're shifting the burden entirely to the public sector. And I think, you know, the public sector can't afford that. We should find ways to make the private sector share in this burden.
I think that would be great, except we already have our test case of 421. As you mentioned, it was put in place in New York, and the turnout really wasn't great. When 421A first went into action, New Yorkers were spending about 20% of their income on rent. When it expired, it was closer to 35%. A third of all tenants across the entire city of New York spend more than half their income on rent. And the organizations that worked on behalf of tenants said 421A ended up costing the city just an increasing, a just ballooning amount of tax revenue, while it didn't actually close that gap and make housing affordable for the average New Yorker.
Well, so these are all adjustments that need to be made to the program. It's the idea, kind of the fundamentals of the program that I'm arguing for. I don't think anybody has a better idea than this program, which has been around for nearly 50 years. And it's something that the city started when Nixon pulled the plug on federal housing subsidies, I think 1972 or 1973. And suddenly cities were left to deal with the problem on their own. They didn't have the resources to build housing on their own. They never have. They don't today. And so they relied increasingly on the private sector to do this, more or less along the lines of what I've described. Now, if it doesn't perform in the way that you like, you adjust the program. You require more affordable units, or you require deeper affordability, or you adjust the tax exemption, whatever it is. But there's all these nice little dials that you can turn to modify the results of the program. And so this program needs to be modified on a regular basis to, you know, to keep it up to date with sort of changing macroeconomic conditions. But instead, New York City just killed it. And now we have, instead of adjusting it and making it better and kind of improving on it, improving on the 50 years of experience that we have with it, we just killed it without having anything to replace it with.
Yeah, except that as of 2022, the city of New York spent nearly $1.8 billion on 64,000 exemptions for 421A.
Right. Okay.
And yet the average income restricted unit in the years just prior cost $1.4 million in current dollars. And less than 9% of 421 units are actually affordable. In other words, affordable that you're going to spend 30% of your income or less on.
Okay,
them.
Again.
Less than 9%.
Okay, but that, again, is just one of the parameters of the program. If you want greater affordability, then you just require participants in the program to set their rents lower, and you might have to adjust the tax exemption for that. Now, when you kind of try and tabulate the costs of 421A to the city, that's a very complicated and confusing thing to do, because the truth is that you cannot build market rate rental housing in New York City because regular taxes on multifamily rental housing are so high that even 100% market rate building cannot afford to pay those taxes. So you need 421A, and it was begun for this purpose, just to get any rental housing built. You need to reduce those taxes on rental housing in order to make anybody's rental project work. So a lot of that subsidy, or a lot of that lost tax revenue, that $1.8 billion you referred to, is actually going to all rental tenants in New York City to lower their real estate taxes so that they can afford their rent. So it's not only for affordable housing, it's for all rental housing. And it's a ridiculous, silly system, but it's just we've sort of taxed rental housing to oblivion. And no one, you know, rental housing simply can't be built because taxes on it are too high. So partially 421A is rectifying that situation. It's messy and complicated to describe.
So we've come to the end of our time, and I really feel like This is such an important topic, and I wish more people would really think about it deeply and discuss it deeply. I feel, John, like you have a lot more faith in corporations and capitalism than I do. I assume that capitalism is always going to kind of overstep the boundaries whenever they can, but you have more optimism about it, and I honor that. Thanks for coming on and talking about this.
All right, thank you. It was fun.
We are sure that you have opinions about this because we're pretty sure you probably live somewhere and you probably have opinions about how much it costs. Let us know what you think. Email us at hearmeout@slate.com. We love hearing your thoughts. I'd love to hear if you think your housing is affordable. Do you agree with our guest or not? Last week, we had Johanna Richland on the show talking about vaccine-hesitant Americans and especially mothers, and we got a really interesting letter in response to that show. We want to share it before we sign off this week. This email came from an anonymous listener who wrote, "I'd like to add that although I have had all recommended vaccines, it was a struggle for me as someone with an anxiety disorder that is majorly set off by anything medical. It's a struggle for people with this condition to see a doctor, a dentist, get blood drawn, get vaccines. Every one of those requirements is a struggle that takes a ton of mental energy and emotional support, if you're lucky enough to have it. And it sucks. I very much appreciated the guest pointing out there are things to fear in medicine, including vaccine reactions, and asking others to go easy on people living in fear. Fear of medical intervention is valid, even if the ultimate correct action is to get it. Once you've experienced medical trauma, it can really cloud what you do for your health in the future." And I really want to say thank you to the listener for pointing this out. And this is something that our guest, Johanna Richland, said as well. And you're all correct. There are a lot of reasons to mistrust our practitioners, to mistrust the medical system, and you're also correct that the ultimate correct action is to get the vaccine, even when it sucks. We really do want to hear from you. Our email address is hearmeout@slate.com. We know you have thoughts to share, so keep them coming. Hear Me Out is a podcast from Slate. The show is produced by Maura Curry. Ben Richmond is the Senior Director of Podcast Operations, and Alicia Montgomery is the VP of Slate Audio. I'm your host, Celeste Headley. Until next time, speak your mind, but keep it open.